Hey, welcome to the show. You are listening to the Rusick Podcast. We are a roots music podcast based out of Nashville, Tennessee, where we talk to the local music scene and beyond.
Today we have Jay Bragg. He is a singer, songwriter, performer, a third generation vaudevillian, and a Christmas aficionado.
If you like what you hear, you're going to want to head on over to our YouTube channel at Rusick Podcast. Over there, you can check out live performances from all of our guests. We also have this podcast that you're listening to right now up with video, so you can watch it as well as listen to it. Give us a follow, subscribe, check it out. My favorite music in the world is traditional music. I love American folk music. I love the...
Oh, no, you're fine.
Oh, yeah,
do it. This is my dad's songbook right here. It. I'm sure we'll probably talk about my family history.
I love it. No, I'm very, very interested in that.
I bring it everywhere because that's amazing. If you want to know who I am, you just look at the back to my family.
That's fantastic.
Third generation.
That's amazing. But yeah, I think about that. I think about that a lot as someone who again, like went to school to study traditional music. And that's the stuff that I love. There is that ongoing battle in one's mind. You want to embrace that music that you love and accept it for what it is. But you also want to recognize that you're living in 2025. You know what I mean? It's like, and that's...
Is that what year it is?
20, I know, right? Yeah. It's scary, terrifying.
It still hasn't sunk in.
I know, right? But that's something that I think about constantly. And I think the less I think about it, the better. Yeah. I think you just kind of need to, like with anything, you need to be a sponge and just take it all in. And whatever comes out and you just sort of hone it to the best of your abilities and try and get it there. But it's that is something I think about a lot. And because I think as a consumer, as just someone who loves music, there is that thing when you're watching someone on stage, pretend like it's not 2025.
Yeah.
That can, which can be, it's interesting because there are performers who do that I adore.
To wear these?
No, I mean, you don't have to if you don't want to. It's really up to you. The big thing is just, being consistent with the mic.
Yeah, I can do that. If you want me to put them on, I can.
It's up to you. But yeah, I think that's an interesting thing that I find. There are people for whom they can live in that world and it doesn't irk me. And then there's other people you watch perform who try to do that. And it's like, it feels fake almost, you know, and it's hard. It's a hard balance to strike. It's a really difficult, thing to do, I think.
But yeah. Yeah. I have a lot of opinions on that subject for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, are we on?
Oh yeah, we're good. Okay. We're going.
I mean, the whole concept of, you know, authenticity, you know, I mean, it's so I wasn't raised with country music. Mm-hmm. I was raised with blues, American songbook music, early pop, you know, Tin Pan Alley type of stuff. My grandparents met in vaudeville. So I'm like a third generation.
That is incredible.
Entertainer, you know, like, so my dad, they met on vaudeville stage. My dad, and they were entertainers their whole life. My dad has been an entertainer his whole life. And my first gig was at age 5, playing violin, playing Turkey in the Straw.
Oh, which that's if, one of my yeah, favorite songs right
roots,
there. There you
if
go.
If you're a roots guy, you know that one. Am I close enough to this mic?
And, oh, yeah. There's a funny story. Since the time I was a little kid, I've loved this music. Mm-hmm. And I remember this is how crazy of a person I am. When I was little, and I was probably 6 years old, maybe seven, I loved all of the old Mickey Mouse cartoons from the 20s and early 30s.
Yeah.
And what my favorite was Steamboat Willie, which they play Turkey in the Straw on that, obviously. And I remember...
Which is now public domain.
Which is, there you go. And I remember... we went out to a restaurant with my grandparents and I don't know why this story came to mind, but we went out to a restaurant in Florida visiting my grandparents. And there were these two musicians, a guitar player and a fiddle player, who were going around playing playing songs. They would go like table to table asking people what songs they want to hear. And they came to our table and here's like 6-year-old Casey being like, I want to hear Turkey in the Straw. Mm-hmm. And they thought it was the coolest fucking thing in the world. This kid like asked for Turkey in the Straw. And in my head, they start playing. I'm like, heck yeah, they know the song. Like, I just thought it was so cool.
That was the Suzuki. I did the Suzuki program.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And so, they started me early on a Cracker Jack box, fiddle, to get your form right. Mm. And then once you got your form right, you got to open up the Cracker Jacks and eat them. So that was the carrot, if there you will.
Interesting.
And, but you know, it was mostly classical. And I remember the first recital we had, in kindergarten, we did, you know, Twinkle Twinkle, a few other, you know, just rudimentary tunes. And then and we ended with Turkey in the Straw. And that was a defining moment in my life because, I mean, I just remember because, you know, the Twinkle Twinkle stuff, you know, I mean, it was just typical recital. Like, yeah. Okay. But it was the Turkey in the Straw that the audience participated in, was clapping their hands and stomping their feet. And I just felt that electric energy from the audience seeing the stage, and it opened my eyes. I mean, I still remember the dust particles coming through the stage lights, and I said, this is magical, being on stage performing this conversation you're having with an audience. This is what I want to do. Yeah. And I was hooked. I was addicted from there. And that really is what started this whole lifelong journey, you know, playing, writing, and performing.
How? Cause so for myself, neither of my parents were musicians. They both love and appreciate music, and that's gotten a lot. That's gotten stronger as time's gone on. But I was never I was never around musicians growing up. Mm-hmm. It was just sort of by strange happenstance that me and my siblings all became obsessed with music, and I'm the only one dumb enough to like commit their life to this thing. But,
right.
But for you as someone who was brought up in it, mm-hmm. what was your relationship like then with it versus now? Was it something that was sort of forced upon you, or was it that was, yeah.
Yeah. I enjoyed having that audience, clapping their hands and showing us that excitement. But, you know, once you get down into, you know, practicing and the, you know, how grueling it is to actually get to the point where you sound halfway decent, you know, that is something that I tried to take many off ramps from, that was not an option. Like my, you know, so my dad is the musician in the family, you know, for my parents, right? Mm-hmm. My mom is very musical. She's more of a dancer. My dad is a musician. However, my mother is the disciplinarian. She's the Italian, and she, you know, quitting was not an option. She came to all my lessons, took notes, made sure that I had the lessons, made sure I had the instruments that I needed. You know, like I said, I started with the violin, and I played violin until about 8, and I just was not really that keen on that instrument, or at least in terms of the classical music that we were working on with Suzuki. So what really changed for me was when I was 8 years old, on Christmas, I got a drum set.
Dangerous shiny, right there. Dangerous.
Shiny Remo little, you know, beginner kit. Mm-hmm. That was another kind of defining moment. I wasn't looking for an off ramp when I was playing the drums. I just loved it. I'm a rhythm player still to this day, you know, whether I'm singing, playing guitar, playing harmonica or kazoo or, piano, I consider myself a rhythm player. And, so I played drums. I mean, the drums were my main instrument. That's all, like I
he was a drummer initially.
Yeah. That's what I started on. Okay. As well. Yes. Yeah, when you're a little kid, something about just hitting shit with sticks is yeah, it's really appealing. It's really fun.
Exactly. Yeah. And you know, I was not a cool kid in school at all. Only child. Lived in a regional school, so all the cool kids went to like athletic practice. And I was the worst athlete ever. I mean, I was tiny, scrawny. You know, I was, you know, 60 pounds soaking wet. You know, it was just like I had no chance at and no hand-eye coordination. Just a lousy athlete. And thankfully, actually, though, because I went home and I just beat those drums. I banged on the drums for, you know, from 3 o'clock. I would get home like 2:30. Put, you know, 12 bagel bites in a microwave oven. I would watch like an episode of The Monkees.
That's the dream.
The original series, The Monkees, you know, on the reruns. Mm-hmm. I would watch that. And then I would spend like, until my parents get home, like 2 hours just practicing drums.
At that point in your life, when it starts to become an obsession, do you think, looking back, the thing that you were falling in love with was songs and music, or do you think you were falling in love with the act of getting good at drums?
It was participating in these songs, and mm-hmm. yeah, it was always like song driven. I would just crank up the tunes and certain, you know, just certain tunes that I was obsessed with at that point, and I just wanted to learn them. And music was the first time that I actually felt like I belonged, like I had something to offer this world. Mm-hmm. 'Cause like I said, I wasn't a good athlete. I was okay in school. You know, very, you know, pretty dorky kid, you know, not like, you know, not the guy that has like all the friends. Certainly not, you know, any girlfriends. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, the girls were repulsed. Yeah. You know,
I do think it's funny because I think in a lot of ways the, you know, the cool kid with a guitar at school is sort of, we have this image in our head of that kid getting all the girls. And I'm sure that happens occasionally, but my experience and my knowledge of other people's experience of being a kid and getting obsessed with music is, no, that's all you do. All you do is you just sit in your room and you just obsess over music.
Yeah,
like, very true.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a sort of an interesting fallacy I find in the world that I'm sure that exists in some way, shape or form, but all the people that I know that have truly been captivated by music as a young person, it's just that's all you want to do. You don't want to do anything
right.
else.
Yeah. Yeah. And it is like your gateway to feeling like somebody, like you have a contribution. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think, most of like if I look at like my heroes in music, a lot of them are more outcast type, you know, loners and, you know, misfits. And, you know, music was that way of kind of understanding the world, of like contributing something. Mm-hmm. And you know, it was, you know, and that was like the gateway for me to actually have community. Mm-hmm. To have other people want to hang out. Yeah. and you know, like my friends would come over and just hear me play like Freebird on the drums. Yeah. You know. And yeah, I would play it all the time, you know, like, all right, play once, play it again. Yeah.
But I think that's where art is so beautiful is, and I agree, all of my favorite artists, whatever world they work in, whether it's music or film or painting or literature or whatever it might be, there is that element of, it's all idiosyncratic to great degrees, because I think that's where universality sits, is it sits in our ability to maybe not find ourselves, but to attempt to find ourselves.
Right.
And when we go through that process, it's like, if you're trying to be like everyone else, if you're trying to make something that's going to knock everyone's socks off, be like, oh, they're all going to relate to this one. You're not really saying anything. And I as a person on the other end of that, whether it's sitting down and reading words on a page or listening to a song, I think one, you can kind of smell that, mm-hmm. but also it's only through that process of trying to be oneself that I think other people can see themselves in that. Mm-hmm. And so when people get good at that skill, I mean, it's a beautiful thing. And it's something that just some people have gotten so good at that it's frightening when you're truly in the presence of great art, of people who go through that process of trying to distill down who they are to some a representation of that in some way, whether it be fiction or otherwise, can be frightening. I think true art can really be, not in a negative sense, but in a almost like in a visceral way, it can just affect you like that.
Yeah, I think it is a journey of self-discovery, self-actualization. I think the artist spirit is one that it's constantly evolving. You know, that's why it doesn't really fit into the norms of like category genre, specifically fitting into certain boxes.
That's a very good way of saying it. Yeah, I think all of my favorite art, whatever medium, it is beyond genre.
Yeah, I mean, it's like,
and it's ever changing.
And I love, you know, my genres from when I started to what I'm doing now have changed wildly, mm-hmm. and it's all about what. Okay, I've you know, spent a lot of time on the blues. I've spent a lot of time on rock and roll. I've spent a lot of time on jazz. Mm-hmm. I spent, you know, when I came here, it was, you know, discovery of like, I'm like, you know, Magellan, you know, going uncharted waters and finding new lands and civilizations.
And that's the fun of it. Like that I think is what brings, again, to kind of draw a parallel to the music that I really cherish in life. All of those people that mean the most to me and that I think are on the right track, whatever that is, go through it exactly the same way that you just articulated, which is it's this constant state of discovery. It's this constant state of, okay, there's this whole world here that I'm yet to dip my toes into. Let's do that for a while. And then you start to get your bearings and you say, okay, I'm starting to understand at least maybe on a surface level how this, but let's try this. Let's go this way.
And yeah,
that is, I think, where the fun of this is. And I think there are certainly people who can live in one particular world and can be incredibly competent at that. And I think that there is a beauty to that as well. But
I couldn't do it.
I couldn't do that either.
I got, you know, when I came here because I really want to know everything and become, you know, gain like, you know, my doctorate in country music.
So you moved out here a decade ago?
2015. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So
okay,
a decade.
Okay.
Yeah. Just about. And so I was up in Maine, Big Fish and Small Pond, playing in a band called North of Nashville. You know, we were doing a lot of touring. It was a two-man kind of outlaw country, mm-hmm. Americana type thing. So I would have bass drum, and I still do this a lot. I'm going to be doing it this weekend up in Maine. I'm doing a tour with North of Nashville, but I played a bass drum with my right foot. You know, I'm standing up, bass drum, right foot, mounted tambourine, left foot, guitar, harmonicas, and singing.
Mm-hmm. That's fantastic.
And then I have my buddy Andrew playing the fiddle, and he was just, you know, and you mic that kick drum, you know, and you mic the guitar right, or you know, you EQ things right, and you know,
sounds,
you close
like
your eyes,
bucks,
and you think there's got to be at least three people on stage, and you know, we were able to tour the country because it was so economically sound, mm-hmm. you know, just doing the two-man thing, but I was yearning, like the stuff that I was listening to when I was in Maine, because I grew up with more like, you know, more freewheeling blues, rock and roll, jazz, and folk music. But I was really, you know, I was like obsessed with like Merle Haggard, George Strait, mm-hmm. Alan Jackson, and you know, Randy Travis, some of these like great vocalists, and everything's really, really clean, you know? And there was, you know, not much improv, you know? And like, so I, you know, the first, from 2015 to, you know, I mean, I I made several records that were that are straight up country records. I went on tour with Alan Jackson, got a chance to go, got asked to go out on and open up for his arena tour in 2019.
That's amazing.
Which was a huge, huge deal. Yeah, one of the best, one of the biggest opportunities I've gotten, I think, here. And you know, and so I really, but I think once I kind of gained everything I was looking to gain and understand about country music, the traditional side of it, then I was kind of ready to move. Now what's next? All right, yeah. I have that. That's now part of my tool chest.
That's in the tool belt. Let's go learn something else.
I've now learned this skill. What's next? And, you know, so like a lot of I've had fans that probably wish that I still made like straight up country, like honky tonk music. And I still do that, you know, I still write those songs and I still play them, you know, live. But right now, like what I'm obsessed with now is like going back, I got my dad's songbook here, right? There's 431 songs. These are the songs that he plays all the time. And I'm going back to more like Tin Pan Alley type of writing. So way back in like the 1920s, 1930s, 1940s, these writers like, you know, Johnny Mercer, you know, Cole Porter, Irving Berlin, you know, Harold Arlen, these type of writers that were blending, you know, their jazz and classical chops into, you know, early popular music. I'm a product of vaudeville, you know, that's where my grandparents get their roots. And, you know, I'm obsessed with that kind of like performance art, the variety show. You know, I'm actually developing a way of a reboot of the variety show that I'm going to call New Vaudeville. Which is gonna be, cause I, when I go see shows, to be honest with you, even major acts, you know, there's a lull, you know, say if they're playing a 2-hour show, about an hour in, I just sometimes they could be killing it. And I just want a little bit of variety. Okay. Mm-hmm. So my concept now is bringing back that vaudeville idea where, yeah, you have a music act or two, but you also have a magician. You also have a ventriloquist, a contortionist, a fire eater, you know, an illusionist. Okay? Yeah. Like, no one's doing that shit.
Yeah. No.
I love the idea.
So that's, like, I told my dad this because, you know, I mean, he's Mr. Vaudeville, and, you know, he got it from his grandparents, and he's like, you got to do that. The hardest thing will be finding the talent, like people who have this, like these circus abilities.
I think it's, you know, oftentimes people complain about the current state of art or performance, pick whatever box you want to check. And I'm sure that there is some validity to some of that. But I also think that there's never been a better time to explore ideas like that. Because now, thanks to the internet and how connected we all are, I think there is a real possibility to have a sort of resurgence of that kind of performance and to be able to get the best of the best together to really put on a captivating show like that. I mean, I think now you can absolutely do that. Whereas even, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago, that would have been, I think, a taller order. But I'd love to see something like that come to fruition.
I think people's like, you know, we have very short attention spans that I think almost the culture is demanding a little bit of variety into a show. And I like working in humor, and I like working in like, you know, some dancing and just some old fashioned show busy type stuff.
As a songwriter, just to kind of, I'm going to pick your brain about this a little bit. As a songwriter, I think that one of the most difficult tones to strike is humor. Oftentimes when people talk about humor in songs, it can be sort of dismissive and we can kind of look down. We can really look down on it as sort of, you know, there's those songs and then there's the real stuff. I'm not one of those people myself either. And I really think that, I think the hardest thing in songwriting to do is to truly be humorous and to really put, to approach that in a serious way. I think that that's certainly the case in certain music of that era. I think of the Tin Pan Alley sort of golden era, there is great material in that. I think that in the Medicine Show world, I think that there's great material in there. I think we, as a culture, we've done it successfully before, but contemporarily, we're not as sure-footed with it for some reason. We almost feel like, I don't know if we can pull this off right now. For you as a songwriter, do you have that sort of hesitation when you really try to bring humor into a song, or is it, do you think of it more as a challenge?
You know, I remember the first like kind of big meeting I had here with a publisher. I came in with like five really, like, you know, songs that would tug at your heartstrings, right? And I felt like I was going to really impress this guy. And he's like, "You got any funny songs?" I'm like, "Well, you know, funny songs, jeez, you know." I'm like, "Oh, really? I don't have any. You know, I don't have any songs that are, you know, laugh out loud funny." Yeah. I actually did that. I just forgot that I did not expect that question from him. I thought he was wanting my deepest material, you know? And I think the
funny stuff can be the deepest material. You know what I mean?
Like, the thing, if it's done well, I mean, yeah, I think know, it is. There's several guys. I mean, you know, one off the bat, you know, John Prine. There is just this, you know, wry sense of humor. And so much of what he does, Paul Simon, you know, will drop, you know, this dry humor in so much of his music. You know, I think to do it well, I mean, you know, I think, you know, great comedians, I have so much respect for comedians. I think you are an evolved species if you are a very good comedian. If
we've talked about this as well.
Yeah, I think comedy is probably like one of the most difficult art forms you could possibly do.
I would agree. Yeah. With music, we can hide behind the songs. if we're starting to bomb or whatever, you just go to that song that you know that's going to get the crowd back. You are so naked up there as a comedian. And I think comedians, when I'm like looking for inspiration, like say on stage, of how can I be a better performer, like be a more magnetic performer for the audience. I don't go to musicians, not modern day musicians. Mm-hmm. I look to comedians because that's a masterclass. The ones who really, really do that well. And you have to be so intelligent to make that
work. Sure. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And I find that all of my favorite performers, or many of my favorite performers, approach it in that same manner. And that is, I mean, that in and of itself is a life's pursuit. It's that finish line you're never going to cross.
Yeah.
But it is such a fulfilling thing to work towards.
Yeah.
I mean, like someone, you know, I think having humor in the songs themselves is a skill. And again, a lot of my favorite songwriters, you know, whether it's Prine or whether it's Warren Zevon or Randy Newman or Lou Reed or whomever, there's so many of them have that ability to truly make you laugh. That's a skill in and of itself, but there's also a skill of just performing, of being on that stage as a performer and being captivating. Mm-hmm. That is a hard skill. Someone like Todd Snyder, who I think is, Todd is one of the best performers probably alive at this moment. And he can just stand on stage and talk to an audience and you're captivated. But that people, I think, see that and they often think that that's something that it's just innate in you as a person or it's not. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, that is decades and decades and decades of refinement and trying to get good at that skill. I mean, the man keeps every set list that he's ever performed in every location. Mm-hmm. He knows every story he's ever told. It's a craft like anything, and you get good at that craft. For you, do you
know who Steve Poltz is at all?
Absolutely,
he's another one.
Steve Poltz is one. We've been just talking about him recently. Mm-hmm. He's one of my favorite songwriters in the world. I think he does the same thing.
Yeah,
exactly. There are people who are just.
But the thing is, the key ingredient here is to be very, very, very comfortable in your own skin.
Yes. Yes,
and
absolutely.
That is, I think, that is, you can't really teach that. It either comes from, it comes from a lot of experience on stage, but really the inner work that goes into becoming comfortable in your own skin. Forget performance. But just being
just life in general.
I think that is, there are elements of that skill that apply when you're on stage. I think there are also elements of that skill that apply when you're checking out the grocery store. You know what I mean? It's like you need to be competent in both. I think you need to be, I completely agree. You need to be wholly yourself in any situation. And people like Steve Poltz or Todd Snyder, I think, are incredibly capable of doing that. And they're also incredibly capable of putting in the time to be just unbelievable performers when that proscenium is there, when they're on that stage. Those are two incredible skills. I would argue the former is probably more useful because it transcends the performer. It's a part of just who you are going through life. And I think that is probably the secret ingredient to being a performer is putting the work in on that. Cause a lot of people, I think, overlook that. A lot of people don't realize that that's such an important part of the equation. And that's a really hard place to get to. That's probably the hardest to get to, period. Mm-hmm. For you, what has that journey been like in your life to get as close to that as you can?
Therapy. I've been in therapy for 15 years. I practice, meditation. I do a lot of journaling. I have a lot of, every day is a day where I am getting closer to understanding myself and my place in the world and how I can be useful, how best I can be useful to this world. It is trying hard not to care what others think of you, which is excruciatingly, it's a very tall order, especially, in the digital age when, your value is often judged by, digital metrics that are available for all to see. I think one of the things that meditation taught me is how to be undistracted and being totally present, and finding that flow state. You know, when you're on stage, that doesn't matter where, if you're being creative, it's you're going to do your best work when you find that flow state. And that requires you to be very much absolutely present, non-distracted. And that is what I'm searching for anytime I am playing music is to lose myself, like lose the facade of Jay, and all that is there, all that I'm living in is music. And having this conversation with the other musicians on stage or allowing the music to go where it goes. If it's just me and my guitar, it's really hard to do because you have all these external factors of judgment, it's very hard to get there. But I think the more you are secure in who you are, accepting of your strengths and weaknesses, believing in your value, whether this crowd might, I've played a lot of shows where it's like, what is with these guys? This is like my best material. I'm doing a great job. There's no reaction here.
We've all been
we've all been there, right? But it's oftentimes like whoever's in that crowd, you might not be for them. You know, like I make music, like I stopped playing like a lot of honky tonk, like downtown. Like I did a lot of lower Broadway type stuff. And I don't really do it anymore. For a lot of different reasons. But one of the reasons is like, I don't really make music at this point in my life for people that are just partying. Mm-hmm. That's not what what I do. Like, I can do that. I have done that thousands of times. But I'm searching for something far deeper. I'm looking to reach your soul and to have a conversation. I want you to understand, like, I want to inspire. I want to be inspired. I want to be aspirational. I want to have fun. I want to channel joy. I want to show you what love looks like and make you feel happier and more joyful and want to be more kind to people when you leave the show and feeling uplifted, like that song Light It Up. It's all about like kind of being this light. Because, you know, I mean, let's face it, we live in a pretty dark times right now. I mean, I am like a bit of a political junkie. I don't really bring my politics in my music as much, but it's dark. And all the more that you know, I think the best serves, I mean, I could write topical songs all day about, you know, how we're leaning into autocracy, you know, how we are repeating, you know, mistakes from... you know, from the mid 1930s Germany, like it, you know, to me, it's pretty clear where this is heading. I can write very, very topical songs on that subject, or is that a best use of my time, or is making somebody feel better, making somebody like allow them to soothe their soul for a little bit. I'm more in the business of giving you a vacation from that, because, you know, and off stage, if you want to talk about, you know, politics, I'm happy to do it. I think that conversation needs to be had, but I think my job is much better served, as somebody who is a uniter, as somebody who can somehow, just remind us what we have in common, to remind us to laugh and to smile and to be joyful. That's where like my family history, the vaudeville family history, that's what vaudeville was. Vaudeville came through a time of the Great Depression.
It's that escape is really what it is.
Yeah, it was an escape. Yeah, totally. And it was for common folk, you know, whose lives were miserable. You know, I mean, this is before, you know, you had labor laws. And I mean, these people work 16, 17, 18 hours a day sometimes, you know, a lot of them immigrants. So their lives were really, really hard. So this is form of escapism. It wasn't putting your head in the sand, just being like, ignore the problems of the world. It was a bit of it was a respite.
Yeah, you need a break every once in a while.
Yeah, I also constantly remind myself as well that even just the process of suffering is a blessing. It's very, very rare for me that I'm playing a show where everyone in the room has paid to come see me, right? You know, usually you have you might have a good chunk of the room there for you. They might have a good chunk of the room there for other people. Some people would have just showed up, right? I think that environment, which is what the environment that most of us live in as musicians, right? Most of us as musicians, it's few and far between that we play a show where everyone's paying for their ticket to come sit down and watch you, right? Mm-hmm. That's sort of a certain level where you get to, and that happens, and that's a blessing. But but I'm always reminding myself that even though that's most frequently not the world that I live in, I love the exercise of being on stage with a room full of people who probably don't know what my thing is.
Right.
And the challenge of that. And I think that actually, and maybe this is just trying to always look at these things through a positive lens, but I think as a performer, I would actually rather be in that situation. Right? I'm sure that there are benefits monetarily and otherwise that come with the other, right? I'm sure that's a good thing. But as a performer, when I actually sit down and do the intellectual work of thinking, what do I actually prefer? I think I like the situation better. I think I actually enjoy being on stage and that play with an audience of, do you care about this? Can mm-hmm. I get you to care about this? And I'm sure some of that is, again, just trying to have a positive outlook on the situation you're in. But I really do think that that's true. I do think that one of the things that I've fallen in love with as a performer is that give and take and that play. For you as a performer, do you get a kick out of that? Is that something that you enjoy, or is that a different...
Yeah, I mean, you know, I love the challenge. You know, sometimes, like, when the crowd is just kind of, you know, somewhat engaged, you know, it's that challenge. I think it's easy when you go up there and everybody's there to see you. Mm-hmm. It's paid a ticket. And I mean, it's just like shooting fish in a barrel, you know, and it's wonderful. I think everybody should like get some strong bar band experience.
Yes.
Like
here.
seriously. I think there are less opportunities for that. Not so much here. I mean, we have plenty of that here.
Yeah, we're very lucky in Nashville right. In that regard.
But like even the places that I grew up, playing, especially up in Maine, I went to college in Vermont and then I went to Maine, and that's where I got like my, you know, let's say I got my bachelor degree in bar band experience, right? But like 75% of those bars they're either not there or they don't have music anymore. So I think there's less opportunities to start a band and to play gigs mm-hmm. for people who don't know who you are, and you have to figure out, you know, what is it that you do, how you engage an audience, what is it, bring in, you know, kind of your autobiography and kind of build a show and figure out how to perform and how to put out fires, because there's a lot of fires put out on especially on a bar band.
And contemporarily, it's very interesting as well, because nowadays it does seem like, you said, there are less opportunities for that kind of thing. But also I think that with social media and I'm not a social media hater as a consumer. I don't really use it, but I use it for music and for promotion, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But I'm not going to sit there and scroll through TikTok. Like, I'm just not that kind of person. But it is interesting because there is a whole other skill set or whole new skill sets that are developing as to how you can perform through social media. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because for me, I find I don't really have interest in it, probably to my detriment, right? It's probably not a good thing that I would rather hone the skills on a bar band stage, you know, mm-hmm. like getting comfortable with that than getting comfortable with performing
to my phone.
Yes. But I don't know. I, again, it's like, and I can intellectually sit here and understand that all day, but I just don't really care. And I'm sure there's a level of necessity there that, as we've all done, we've all gotten better at that over time because it is such a new thing. But I don't love that the same way that I love getting on stage and performing at a shitty dive bar. I do, however, feel that there is a new generation of people coming up for whom that's just what performing is. Performing is, and I think it's only going to be exacerbated as time goes on, mm-hmm. right? It's only going to be more of what being a performer is. Well, you stick a phone in front of you and you do. And it's interesting because it's even just the idea of compositions, right? If you're composing for a live performance, right? Mm-hmm. We kind of know the world that we know the sandbox you're playing in. Whereas if you're performing or composing for a 30-second, you know, Instagram reel, then you just need 30 seconds of music. There doesn't need to be anything on either end of that, right. You know? So it's like even on the sort of fundamental level of conception, these things are different. Like for you, as time has gone on and social media has kind of gotten more involved in all of our lives, mm-hmm. what is your relationship with it currently, and how has it changed as time has gone on?
It's a love-hate relationship.
That's a loaded question.
Yeah, no, it's a love-hate relationship. I mean, yesterday I was swearing at Mark Zuckerberg for 30 minutes. I said, I fucking hate Facebook over and over and over again, you know, because it was some login issue. And, you know, it is, okay, so... I made a kind of a post the other day about, you know, the quest, like there's, it's tough being a musician because, you know, to continue to be successful and grow your audience while at the same time being successful at, like for me, I want more inner peace. Mm-hmm. You know, I want to be less agitated. I want to be more patient.
Yeah, social media certainly does not help with that.
Exactly. I want to have less anxiety. I want to. So, like all of the things that I know will help, or that I need to work on to be the best version of myself, and to be the most healthiest person I can be mentally, physically, emotionally. All those things are at odds to the demands of social media and keeping up with that algorithm, staying in good graces with the algorithm. You know, and it's constantly, I don't chase virality, but I know that everybody feels good if they have a post that,
it does well.
That does really well. And then you're like, okay,
you're always chasing the dragon.
Yeah,
you're always chasing the dragon.
Exactly. And there's never enough. Like, you know, you could get a million views. That feels good until the next day and your next post is like 100. And it's like, oh, I suck. Like this is a total fluke. It's not like specifically creative work, because there's always like kind of a sales pitch involved. I think TikTok, where it is, you know, like the content I think that is really magnetic, is the stuff that is completely unrehearsed. It is really off the cuff. It's like not edited clearly at all.
No, I agree. That's the most captivating.
Right. Yeah. And like that is kind of the antithesis of like Instagram, where it's more airbrushed, where you're kind of putting a facade out, where it's constantly, you know, sales pitchy.
Yeah.
You know, not really connected to reality, but the reality, you know, or there's the perception that you're trying to push out to the world. You know, that said, what I do is, I mean, I'm a creature of routine. You know, I wake up generally at the same time. You know, take a long walk with my dog. I practice gratitude. I speak out loud the thing, like 5 to 10 things I'm grateful for. Then I say, where am I winning in life? Like, what did I do yesterday, basically, that pushes me forward to be a better person? And then I go through, what is, like, my ideal day look like for today? And kind of I set my intentions for the day. This is all with this walk with my dog. And then the fifth thing is, what will I let go of today? And then that equips me. Then I go back. And I make an espresso, and I go, and I do maybe about an hour of work, and usually I will allow half an hour for content, and then it's time for breakfast at 10, and I'm on social media. If I'm following the rule that I'm trying to set for myself, I really don't worry about content for the rest of the day. Mm-hmm. However, a lot of people message you through the app, and the thing is, you open the damn thing up and it sucks you in.
And it's so time. I mean, so for me, I, There was a stint in my life where I was exclusively doing lessons. Like I just kind of went all in on doing music lessons, and so I was constantly doing content, and I was constantly putting out content on Instagram and on YouTube. And you know, you look at a 5-minute video that you've put up, and somebody sees that and they think that equals 5 minutes of work, but it's also time consuming. I mean, obviously something like this is on a whole other scale, because you know, there's so much involved with this kind of thing, where not just editing the thing and then but the promotion through different social media, but like something like a podcast, I think is more, it's a little bit more understandable. Someone sees that and can kind of understand, okay, I get the level of work involved to get something out there like that. But even if you're just looking at, you know, 5 minute, 1 minute, you know, guitar lesson videos, it just eats away all your darn time. Yeah. It's one of those things where I think until you experience that and you really try to go, you know, go deep into the weeds.
Yeah.
You kind of take it for granted, and then you're in it and you're like, this sucks.
Yeah.
where did the last 2 hours of my life go?
Right. Know? And
so having those,
you're not really creating.
Oh anything. Yeah. No, not at
you
all.
You know,
yeah.
That said, I like to, so say if I'm working on, like this morning, I was working on playing that old Scott Joplin song, The Entertainer. I was just working on the chord changes, and I was doing the melody on kazoo. And that was like kind of my, you know, half an hour like practice session, you know, from about like 9 to 9:30 this morning. I'm like, oh yeah, I got a cool like arrangement for this thing. And then, so like, I'm like, I'll just set up my phone, because like I can document this for myself. Like, it's good enough to present. And so maybe like in my practice, or if it's writing a song, you know, maybe like I'll get something, you know, 75%. But if I'm going to present it to someone, I want it to be like, you know, 99 to 100%. So give it a little extra juice, and you know, and so I think that it's almost like a game that you play with yourself. It's like, okay, you know, you did good practicing that tune, but is it good enough to present to other people? And that's kind of a perfectionist.
That is one of the things I do like about social media, is that because you have to get something to a presentable form, it kind of forces you to work it up further to a point than you would have if you didn't have social media, because you're like, oh, I want to post about this or whatever, you know, and you have to get it to 100, you know, where without that, you know, you might stop at 75 and move on to something else.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So I think that is a good thing that comes out of it for sure.
Yeah.
One thing I wanted to ask you, kind of stepping back a little bit, as someone who grew up with that world around you, what did you find as a kid was the first music that you discovered that was yours?
Interesting. Well, I mean, I always feel like I'm borrowing, constantly, you know, borrowing from the stuff that I've absorbed. But what do you mean specifically that was mine?
I mean, when as a kid, we all are subjected to our parents' musical tastes,
right,
et cetera. But what was the music you found that, especially as someone who grew up with a pretty regimented approach to music, and someone where it kind of seems like that was something as a young person that was thrust upon you more so than a choice.
Okay.
What was the music that you discovered that you felt passionate about, where you thought, oh, this is something outside of what I'm accustomed to hearing in the home that I really love, that moves me, or that I think is exciting?
Like the grunge scene in the 1990s, for sure. I feel grateful that, I mean, I think for rock and roll, I lived through kind of a renaissance period. There was like, you know, the 60s and 70s, 80s was kind of lame for rock.
Rough, yeah.
but the 90s was brilliant. I mean, you know, it's we'll never see that again. You know, rock and roll, I mean, that's a whole other podcast, but like, you know, so, you know, But, you know, a lot of the stuff coming out of Seattle, you know, in, you know, Nirvana, Soundgarden, you know, Pearl Jam. I mean, I loved Green Day. I remember I went to, I presented, you know, I went to a Christian school. And we had a class of, of contemporary Christian music class, right? And at the end of the suffering through all these lame songs, right, that you could bring in what you were listening to, the music that is yours. And I brought in the Dookie album by Green Day. And I gave a whole presentation on it, you know. And I remember my teacher really didn't like it. He didn't like my presentation or the music. And he said, well, I think Jesus would feel differently about this music.
But that's how you know it's good.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it made me want to listen to it a lot more. Yeah, yeah. I will tell you that.
You're like, when I come around, it's never sounded so good.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, you know, like the music that was peaking through, like, I would say, like, you know, 92 to 96, 97, like, you know, all that rock and roll, that was like the first time I was like, this is my music, this is my generation. I felt connected with, like, the music. Like, now I usually feel connected with old forms of music. Mm-hmm. That was one of the only times, I think, in my life that I felt connected with current music, that I thought it was speaking my language, that it was articulating the things that, you know, the experiences that I was having, the feelings that I was having and emotions I was having. So I feel super grateful to have.
Yeah. It's an interesting thing because I know for, you know, Brian and I we're pushing 30 and, mm-hmm. it's one of those things where, you know, as a kid, there were certainly times when the local music scene was really important to me. Like I grew up in a time when sort of the math rock scene in the SoCal, yep, area was big. And like, so that kind of thing, I always felt, you know, you can dial into those moments, but culturally on the whole, when I kind of step back and look at the macro, there's never been a time in my life where what the big thing of the day is relates to me. I've never had that relationship with, when I say pop music, I don't mean as, right, a genre, but popular music. Sure. It's never been there. And I do, part of me is always fascinated by people that have had that relationship with popular music in the past, because that's been the case through, it seems like, all of, you know, the last 70 years up until about 5 seconds ago. Mm-hmm. I'm always just interested by people who, by people's relationship to popular music and to that sort of feeling of, maybe not collectivism, but that feeling of being one of the thing of
yeah,
the
zeitgeist of,
yeah,
the moment.
Exactly.
I mean, I really never thought about it in those terms, but that was the only time that I felt connected with the music of that modern time, mm-hmm, that, you know, that I was living through.
When, as you got a little bit older and you started to listen to more kinds of music, mm-hmm, when did you find that, kind of going back to this really, when did you find that you became aware of your connection to the music of your family and your family's past? When did you sort of rediscover it on your own to find that you had a love and a connection to that kind of music outside of just it being forced upon you?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, just in that matter of, you know, that journey of self discovery, self actualization and wanting to know, I think at some point, a lot of people want to know where they came from and dig into their roots a bit more. And, you know, I've always performed with my dad. I still do. My dad's, you know, in his mid 80s now, still performing, at, you know, nursing homes, and he came out on tour.
That's
with us.
Amazing.
He did our Christmas tour with us this year.
That's awesome.
But I always you know, I always loved, because he would always play this music from, like, you know, the vaudeville era, like the Tin Pan Alley era, the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, you know, like probably 1965 is probably the last cover. He probably doesn't know too many stuff after that. You know, it's like old stuff. And I started really coming back, I think just musically, I was needing some inspiration, and I felt a little bit lost. Like after, like, you know, I kind of like did the Alan Jackson thing and was really, you know, really kind of sinking into the country thing. And I'm like, all right, you know, this is cool. I like it stylistically. There's a lot of, you know, stylistically, sonically, there's a lot of love about it. Culturally, didn't really feel a kinship with it as much. So, you know, I started like, well, where does my roots, you know, what is the music of my roots? And I started just like to understand where I was going to go, you know, what waters I was going to go, you know, uncharted waters I was going to try to explore next, was asking my dad. I'm like, Dad, will you write down your entire set, or send me, you know, I thought he had this all typed up, right? He does it shorthand, okay? I mean, look at this. Page after page.
That's amazing.
He writes this all with a pen, a pencil and paper. Oh, like all these songs. And he sends this to me.
That's a lot of songs.
Yeah. And like, I'm like, this is it. Like, if ever I need a North Star, where I'm like, you know, because you can get pulled in all these different directions as a professional musician, as an artist, you know, and trying to understand, like, you know, how, you know, you need to pay the bills. Like, you know, it can lead you down some paths that aren't as fruitful as others. It can bring you a little bit further from the garden than your heart really wants to go, you know. I followed the muse back like three generations to really, like, a lot of this stuff is his parents' music. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I had to go back to go forward in a lot of ways.
Brian and I have had this conversation on here before, but I do think, at least as far as popular music goes, that era of Tin Pan Alley being king has really never been rivaled. And I think because of the world we live in now and the way in which the music, not just the music industry, but technology, the way we interplay with technology, we're never going to see something like that again. I think that is really the kind of crown jewel of American popular music. But when you listen to those songs, what is it specifically about them that you find the most compelling? Because I just think it's some of the best songwriting we've had as a society.
We talked about it. It's melody, you know, it's those melodies. I mean, even a song like King of the Road, right? I mean, that is, what a sophisticated melody over a three chord song. Trailer for sailor ran, round the land of 50 cents. No phone, no pool, no pets. Da 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 ba da da ba da da ba ba da ba ba da ba ba da 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 da. I mean,
Roger's the best. Yeah,
that's like a jazz melody, and it's over three chords. Like that is a die. I mean, that art of like, of being super, I think, inventive, creative, with, and stretching the boundaries of like, what notes can you put that, you know, in these chord progression, whether it be a sophisticated, you know, 12 chord progression or a simple three chord song.
Speaking of another guy who could really throw humor in a song, you know what I mean?
Like, yeah, exactly. And so like it's the melody that really, because a lot of those songs, the lyrically were pretty simplistic, you know. they were, you know, about you know, I think, you know, most of them were simple love songs about relationships, but it's the melody, and you know, the what I love, like everything that I play has got to swing. I love that element of swing, of you know, I love anything that has a good shuffle, some swing to it.
Gracias.
And a lot of that is like my obsession with the blues.
Yeah.
You know, Louis Armstrong is probably my favorite musician ever.
He's up there. He's if we got a Mount Rushmore, he's certainly on it. Yeah. I think, I mean, as someone who, one of my great joys in life in regards to music, really the two that I cherish the most is songwriting and the act of putting songs together. I think is fascinating, just looking under the hood and seeing how they work. But then also the lineage of music, of American music, I think is absolutely fascinating, and seeing, tracking how we have gotten to the various forms of music that we have, I think is just, I mean, it's one of the things that I just obsess over in life. I think it's really fascinating. And that the popular music of that era is incredibly unique because it is this very lightning in a bottle moment where all of these seemingly disparate forms of American music are caught together. Mm-hmm. And that is, that's happened continuously throughout American history, whether it's the blues, whether it's rock and roll, whether it's happened quite a few times where we've gotten these interesting amalgamations of things. Because of technology, we're not going to see something like that again, really, which is some ways kind of sad, but it's the world continues to move on. But I do find for that kind of popular music, it's just, it is a very, very unique blend of ingredients that gets you there. And it just gives you a very interesting output. It's different than jazz. It's different. I mean, I think the great American art form, the two great American contributions to the world are probably jazz and the Western. You know, like I think those are probably the two things that we've brought to the world that are the most potent.
Two distinctly American art forms.
But there is something interesting about that music that is different than blues. It's different than jazz. It's different than country music. It's different than all these incredible forms that I love. And I always find it's very difficult to put my finger on exactly what it is of that era, but it is that lightning in a bottle. It is that, that immediate capture of the moment that, you know, jazz was huge in its heyday, but it was never the popular music of the time in the way that kind of music was. You know, country music is much the same way.
In the swing era, I mean, you know, Benny Goodman was as big as any.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
But yeah, it was
Charlie Christian was
in,
yeah.
In terms of its, in terms of jazz being pop, the pop of the time, it was probably that swing era.
Exactly. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it's just interesting. I think that looking at how that kind of music also evolved into different things too is really fascinating. But when you sit down and you have a document like that that you can pore over,
yeah,
what of it? Are there songs in there that you were surprised that were in there? Like, were there ones that kind of caught you off guard, or was it more or less what you expected?
Oh no, there's a lot of surprises in here. I mean, like, look, I mean, you know, Blowing in the Wind, you know, that is, my dad loves Dylan, as do I. And there's, you know what, there's some really, I mean, most of them I've heard him sing before, but I would go through and I'm like, I didn't know you did that song. Like, what was he working on? We Are the World. He was working on this song the other day.
That's funny.
You know, the Michael Jackson, Lionel Richie, you know.
That's funny. The super song.
Yeah. And like, so my dad, I mean, it's incredible. Like, because he has his gigs, and those gigs, I think, keep him alive. Like Puff the Magic Dragon, you know? I forgot about that song.
That's a good one.
But like, he's constantly working on new material. Like, a whole section on Al Jolson. I mean, this was vaudeville.
I do love me some Al Jolson.
But yeah, and there's a lot of Beatles on here. You know, My Girl, which I do that one all the time. I mean, I do most of these songs. I do, and the ones that I don't, I'll just pick this thing up and I'll start learning them.
As someone who, like all of us, has a vast array of music that I think interests you, who are the biggest influences with at this point in your life when you step back and you see, okay, who are the musicians, songwriters that have had the biggest impact on you, the kind of pound for pound kings and queens, who do you think they are?
They're you know, like I mentioned, you know, Bob Dylan, I mentioned Paul Simon, Bruce Springsteen has always been, and Springsteen, both as a writer and as a performer, I've seen Bruce like 15 times, I think. Which is actually not a lot to like some super fans. You know, I know some people from Jersey who's like, 15, come on, you're still a virgin.
Rookie numbers.
I love Irving Berlin, Cole Porter, you know, Hoagy Carmichael. I love Hoagy all the time. there's just so many. John Prine, I love John Prine's writing. Dean Dillon, guy who's basically written all of George Strait's, you know, hits. Is one of my favorite writers. I just go through kind of seasons of like, mm-hmm. One of my favorite writers of all time. One of the reasons why I moved to Nashville was Kris Kristofferson. He's like one of my heroes. Talk about a brilliant, you know, I mean, Rhodes Scholar. Like, I mean, the guy lives, he's like an American icon, you know, was in the military, Rhodes Scholar. Extremely, extremely, you know, book smart, actor, Renaissance man, you know, he's one of my all time favorites. Merle Haggard, you know, one of my all time favorites. There's a lot.
Yeah.
It's really hard to.
Yeah. And another through line, I guess, that I always think is present with the people that I admire the most is usually they do tend to be. They do tend to be people that have tried a lot of different things.
Mm-hmm.
Don't get wrong. There are people out there that I love that just have stuck with songwriting or performing, and that's all that they've ever done. But I do think a lot of the people that I really admire the most are Renaissance men. They're people who just wanted to try different things and oftentimes were quite good at a large swath of different things. We've talked. There's quite a few people I think that Brian and I talk about on here that kind of meet that criteria. But like someone like Shel Silverstein, I think is a really good example of that. I mean, that man did a lot of things, and he did a lot of things incredibly well. And it's interesting when you have people like that, because some people will hear that name and they'll think Shel Silverstein, the short story writer, or something. Yeah, they'll think The Giving Tree. Some people hear it and they'll think A Boy Named Sue. Some people hear that name and they'll think of his visual art. Like that's something that I really love, and I think that's actually a really powerful thing as a person, is to not allow yourself to even be boxed in terms of medium, and to transcend that. I think that is one of the hardest things to do as an artist, is to transcend that and to try different things.
Yeah, it's tough because, you know, you want to follow your curiosities for sure. The thing is we don't have time to do everything. So like I've written a manuscript for, I developed a character called King Kazoo, and I do a thing called King Kazoo and the Reindeer Band. We did it for our Christmas tour, which I do a Christmas tour every year called Songwriter's Christmas. And King Kazoo is this fictional character from the North Pole. And I developed this whole, like, storybook manuscript. I've written the manuscript.
I love this.
And my goal, my 2025 goal was to start pitching the manuscript out to publishers because I want to have a storybook version of King Kazoo. It's a really, really interesting story, and it's a Christmas story. And I think, you know, I started digging on, researching and understanding, you know, the process of pitching to publishers for, you know, this one would be, it's like more of a storybook, you know, you call it a children's book, but it's for children and adults like Shel Silverstein's The Giving Tree. I mean, I reread that, you know, a couple months ago, and I wept. I mean, it's a beautiful story.
There is more in those however many pages of that book than there are in most 1,000-page novels.
Exactly.
And that's quite a staggering thing to bear witness to.
So I want to complete this manuscript. I would like to get... I have a really good feeling that the right publisher would want to publish this book. Because it would be also like... You know, anything that is a perennial, perennial content, like a Christmas book, would, you know, is people would be very interested in that.
Absolutely. And
the story is really, really cool and unique. You know, I'm reading, like, what would go into this. I would probably have to devote, 60% of my bandwidth for the year to that. And it's just like, it's hard to know what to focus on. That's a hard thing.
The like, older that I get in life, the more that I understand that it's all just about time. It's not about money. It's all about time. And I mean, even something like this silly show, it's so much fucking time. and again, that's not a complaint. It's just, I think you start to understand that, that you just need to make decisions and say, we're going to do this for a while. And we're going to go down this rabbit hole and see what happens. And it's a hard, it's a difficult balance to strike, but I do think that that's one of the biggest challenges of life is just trying to allocate time the way that you want to. But I would rather be in that situation, right? There's so many things in life that I feel just like, I want to grab life by the horns and just do it. Mm-hmm. And I would rather be in that situation of feeling like there's just not enough hours in the day than to feel like the days are just slowly, slowly inching by. And, you know, like that sounds like an absolute nightmare to me.
Yeah.
Totally.
So besides that, what else is on the horizon? What else you got coming down the pipe?
So I did, I am doing a tour called the Joy of Summer Tour. So I learned a lot from my Christmas concerts, and I like working around a theme, you know, where obviously the theme is Christmas. And so I wanted to do something where the theme is just music that really pairs well with the summer season. So I'm doing a whole, and what I do, it's like 75% originals, 25% covers. It's a bit vaudeville where there's audience participation. So we're going to be doing that. We're going to be doing multiple tours in the Midwest and do some down here, and in the Northeast. I'm getting back in the studio to record some of the tunes that I played earlier.
Heck yeah.
I'm really jazzed up about this new vaudeville idea of this variety show.
I really like this idea.
What I'd like to do, I'm in the scouting portion of it. So I'm trying to scout. If I can scout like maybe a few really unique, unusual acts, like a contortionist,
fire eater.
Like,
we need, yeah.
I would probably need to talk to a lawyer about some of these like swords. I'd love to get a sword swallower.
See, that would be fantastic. Yeah.
But they would have to sign a waiver of some sort.
For sure.
I cannot be liable. And God forbid,
it sounds risky to employ a person who swallows swords. Yes. I don't know how that works.
But they're out there.
Some legalese involved.
I'd be scared to pay.
If you
that
have
guy.
An unusual talent that would have harkens back to
then
the
circus. Hit Jay up. We're gonna make this happen.
Hit me up because what I want to do is we're gonna do the Nashville version of this this summer. Mm-hmm. And what I like to do is do a really stellar job, give people like an experience, like you know, like they've gone back in time, yeah. and really like a period piece of like, you know, the 1930s, and record it. Ideally, we would find a home for this where it would be a weekly residency, someplace mm-hmm. in Nashville, because this wouldn't probably be a traveling show, because getting yeah, a talent like that on the yeah. road would be a big to do. So ideally, I'd like to, I think if we do a really good job with it, and I'm really, you know, I do well with the marketing side of things. That's something I enjoy doing. But I think one of these places that have like a speakeasy type of place that has a stage.
No, totally.
Yeah. They love to do like a
week. Like I could see like a show like that doing really well.
Yeah.
Like, I could see that taking off like, for sure.
Do you know, now I'm just throwing random things. We'll talk after this. I've got some, yeah. I got some spots in town that I think could be really good for that. Yeah, this has been a joy. Thank you so much for doing this. This was fantastic. It's a pleasure. This was a ton. Yeah. This is like a ton of fun. I'm really glad we did it.
Yeah. No, thanks for having me. Thanks for having, you know, these conversations and, you know.
It's been fun.
You got the gift of gab like me.
Oh, yeah. Know? I could talk all day. Yeah. Brian just sits here and looks pretty.
You know? Yeah. Pretty much. Yeah. Well, we need that too, man. I know. Exactly. I'm not giving you that kind of supplement.
Thank you for doing this, man.
Yeah, no problem. Yeah. My pleasure. Cool.
This was a ton of fun.
Yeah, I was really
love the songs too, man.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, those were good. First kazoo on the show.
Oh, okay.
That's a mile. And the first harmonica.
Yeah, that was a big day for us.